You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, the House of Representatives, to quote Danielle this morning, has to look like they're doing something. So they're holding hearings on Ebola. Oh, yes, let's all be very, very afraid. Actually, it appears that if you are a nurse in a Texas hospital where, you know, it's a right to work for less state, there's basically no unions, then good luck. We're going to get into that in some detail in the second hour of our program today when Roseanne DeMauro is going to drop by. She's the executive director of National Nurses United. This is amazing stuff that's going on. I think, though, that probably one of the most instructive stories of the news cycle of the last 24 hours about the state of political debate in the United States, the state of the media in the United States, but most importantly, the state of political debate, was the Charlie Crist, Rick Scott debate down in Florida. Now, for those of you who don't know what I'm talking about or didn't catch this, it is all over the place. And what is all over the place is not that in this debate, find my list here, that in this debate that Charlie Crist beat up Rick Scott pretty badly. You know, that, for example, Charlie Crist said the people, you know, Rick Scott tried to say, oh, you lost jobs when you were governor. I made jobs when I was governor. And Charlie Crist says the people of Florida know I didn't cause the global economic meltdown. See, he was governor back in 2008 any more than Rick Scott caused the national economic recovery. Rick Scott has been governor since 2010, I think it is. So, you know, number one, Scott says, you know, this is all talk versus action. He talked about how Chris took Scott said 30. Well, let me get back to the Charlie Crist defended taking stimulus money to keep teachers in their jobs. Scott attacks him. Chris says, Rick, there you go again, trying to blame the global economic meltdown on me. And I think, you know, one of the most important things is that Rick Scott, if Bill Frist's daddy's company hadn't bought Rick Scott's company, the Rick Scott may be in prison right now. I mean, his Columbia HCA paid a fine of $1.7 billion for crimes committed, specifically Medicare and Medicaid fraud, committed while Rick Scott was the CEO. But because he was already out of the company by the time the fines came down, Scott said, quote, I made sure patients were taken care of. I really could have done a better job to hire more internal and external auditors. Right. But anyhow, what happened last night, instead of, you know, our news media in America telling American citizens that Rick Scott doesn't want to expand Medicaid, Charlie Crist does. That Rick Scott is skeptical of climate change, Charlie Crist gets it. That Rick Scott is, you know, basically a Republican troll, and that Charlie Crist used to be a Republican troll and decided to become a Democratic troll or a Democrat because he was so sick of the Republican trolls. I mean, none of that is being discussed. Instead, what's being discussed is the fact that Rick Scott asked for a fan to be on the floor below his podium, blowing up on him, on a day that was 90 degrees in Florida with 90% humidity. Now, presumably the hall was air-conditioned, but these guys were up on stage with bright lights. And I can tell you, I've been in a lot of air-conditioned amphitheaters, stadiums, you know, in front of crowds from, you know, 100 people to 5,000 people. And if you're on stage and you got a lot of bright lights on you, it gets really hot. And, you know, how did Richard Nixon lose the election in 1960? There are some who say it's because on national television, he started sweating. So Charlie Crist's saying, hey, you know, I'd like a fan on me. That's entirely reasonable.
Rick Scott's argument was that the debate rules say that you can't have electronic devices on your podium. Now, obviously, this is, you know, you can't have an iPad there or the Microsoft variation of it so that you can look stuff up really quick, or you can have cheat sheet or quick notes and things. You can't have that on the, but Rick Scott was like, that fan is an electronic device. Well, yeah, but it's not on the podium. It's under the podium. I mean, it's a tempest in a teapot, but the fact is that the media has totally focused on Rick Scott refusing to come out for 4 minutes because he was throwing a hissy fit over the fan. And thus, everybody forgets, or nobody actually even gets informed to begin with, about the horror story freak show of Rick Scott's past, his criminal past, his present, the fact that, you know, he's quite literally harming people, causing deaths of people in the state of Florida. This Florida is where Charlene Dill lived. Remember Charlene Dill? This was a few months ago, this young woman, mother of two or three kids, who knew that she had a heart condition. And her doctor said, you need to be taking this medication. And she was working three jobs. And because she was working three part-time jobs, she didn't earn enough to qualify for Obamacare subsidies. That would have been like $15,000, $16,000, $17,000, something like that. She didn't make that much money, but she earned too much to qualify for Florida-based state Medicaid. And so she got no health insurance because Rick Scott refused to expand Medicaid in the state of Florida because it's Obamacare. It's a piece of Obamacare. We can't have that. And she died. And her blood is on Rick Scott's hands. Now, I didn't watch the whole debate last night, and I don't know if Charlie Crist brought that up. I certainly would have if I was him. But my point is that look at the coverage. Look at the news coverage all over the country, site after site, news site after news site. What are they talking about? Charlie Crist and Rick Scott had a debate, and Rick Scott refused to come on stage for 4 minutes. You know, I doubt it played out this way, but if I was an advisor to Rick Scott, or pretty much any other Republican in the United States, knowing that if Republicans tell the truth about their positions on the issues, that they're in favor of tax cuts for billionaires and rich people, that they're in favor of outsourcing jobs so that big national, international corporations can make more money, that they're opposed to increasing a minimum wage, that they're opposed to unionization, that they're opposed to things, you know, basically, as Harry Truman said, the Republican Party has always been the party of special interest, always has been, always will be. The Democratic Party is the party of the people. And to a large extent, that is still true. But you would not know that from this coverage, because the coverage is all about the fan. So anyhow, if I was an advisor to Rick Scott, a Republican advisor, I would be saying, hey, if you can get the whole country talking about something stupid like you're being upset about a fan, it'll make you look a little silly, but it won't hurt you as bad as if people learn about your positions on the issues. So go for the stupid stuff. Now, you know, like I said, that would be a high stakes bet. And so I'm guessing that probably Rick Scott just at the last minute decided to throw a hissy fit. But really, if you're going to throw a hissy fit over the other guy having a fan on him, it's almost too implausible. You know, it's almost, and it might be enough to convince a person that conspiracy theory I laid out is actually what happened.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Do you think that Rick Scott planned this in order to divert public attention away from the horror show of Republican policies? And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And as I bring up my call screen software. So I think this is, you know, I don't want to sound like Alex Jones, you know, to go off on some conspiracy theory every day and, you know, all kinds of paranoid and whatnot. But it's there are moments in politics And I think, frankly, this is one of them, where you look at what's going on and you say, you know, how could that be anything other than this? So, on the other hand, you know, might be totally, totally not the case. Bob in Lafayette, Georgia, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network. Hey, Bob, what's on your mind today?
Hey, how you doing, Tom? I'm just probably hitting on a sore subject, but I just want to bring it. You know it, but I'm just going to bring it to your attention. North America, South America.
Right.
Which covers Canada all the way down to Panama.
Well, it covers Canada all the way down to
Venezuela, all the way down to Argentina. Aren't they also considered Americans?
Yeah. Yeah, they are.
I talk about illegal immigrants, Asian Americans, African Americans, European Americans.
Well, from the point of view of Native Americans, we're all illegal immigrants.
I know that. But, you know, people are always saying something about illegal immigrants. These people are from America.
Yeah. This is what you're talking about, Bob, and it's long been a bugaboo for a lot of people. I have been corrected in my use of language in both Mexico City and in Bogota, Colombia, by just local folks, you know, friends, acquaintances that I'm talking with, and I refer to Americans. And they go, we're Americans, too. And it's like pretty much everybody in the Americas, whether it's Central America, South America, Canada, you know, North America, Mexico, North America, they all understand that there are two American continents, and arguably two and a half, Central America being part of something, North America, I guess. Yeah. Basically, you got North America and South America, and everybody who lives on either of those continents can call themselves Americans. So, you know, a good point, but... where are you going with that? What's the point of pointing that out?
Yeah. I just wanted to bring it to you, you know, maybe listeners could understand those people are Americans too, you know.
Right. But they're not citizens of the United States. And that's what's going on is, we use Americans as shorthand for citizens of the United States of America. I don't believe that any of these other countries in the North or South American hemispheres use the word America in the title of their country. It's not the Colombian country of Colombia and America or something like that. I mean, none of the rest of them do. We do here in the United States. We use America as part of the official name of our country. And so, you know, it's not unreasonable for Americans, for citizens of the United States, to call themselves Americans. It's a particular type of shorthand. But I get it. If we want to be, you know, super precise about our language, everybody who lives on either continent is an American. Bob, thank you for the call. Excellent point. We'll be right back. Commentary on the state of our news media that ever since, you know, the 87, the end of the Fairness Doctrine, which required that news actually be news, you know, within a year or two, all three big networks had their news divisions under the aegis of the vice presidents of entertainment, and they all turned from money losing operations to money making operations. Is this a commentary on the sad state of our news media? And now you've got CNN, you know, trying to figure out, well, gee, Anthony Bourdain draws better ratings than actual news does. Anthony Bourdain does a pretty damn good show, I'll say. Although he wasn't the best interview. I had him in the studio in Portland, 5 years ago, something like that. And, boy, an unusual fellow, shall we say. But in any case, his show, great show. Gets great ratings. I love seeing what it's like all around the world and all that cool food. But it's not news. Isn't there, and the same thing, the top-rated show on MSNBC is Lockup. It's a reality show about prison. It's a top-rated show on MSNBC. What does this say about us? I think it says that, you know, the American public is interested in sparkle. Okay, so that becomes then a problem. You say, okay, if we're easily distracted by sparkle, and if infotainment is the new kind of news, and if organizations like Fox News can get away with constantly spinning the news and hyper-politicizing the news to the extent that there's an entire website devoted to daily debunking the lies on Fox News, go over to MediaMatters.org. It'll blow your mind what you see there. What does this say about the state of news in America? And what does this say about the Republican strategies that, you know, Rick Scott, in order to make sure, maybe, I don't know. I mean, it had that effect. Sometimes when something happens, it's because somebody wanted it to happen. Nobody in America is talking about the toxic positions of Rick Scott. Did you find the Harry Truman thought? This is what Harry Truman had to say about Republicans and Democrats. And this is what's not being said in the media today, because Rick Scott had a hissy fit about a fan, and it's what might be being said if anybody had actually bothered to report on the debate, because this is the essence of the debate right here.
The people know the Democratic Party is the people's party, and the Republican Party is the party of special interest, and it always has been and always will be.
There you go. Good old Harry Truman. He's nailed it. Okay, there's a bunch of other things in the news also, and then I want to get to your phone calls here. But the rap sheet on Rick Scott, remember yesterday it was either yesterday or the day before when I think the sequence was, as I recall, Tuesday, on this program, and those of you who watch regularly will remember what I'm talking about. Tuesday, I said, and I point these things out to you when I see them. I've been pointing them out with increasing regularity over the last few months, that there were two stories in the Financial Times, you know, rich people talking to rich people about why the economy, why the economy is going to crash, but more importantly, why the stock market's going to crash. And one was about how commodity prices are falling, and in large part, that's because consumption by Chinese industry is decreasing. And industry in Germany and industry in the United States, consumption of raw materials is decreasing from oil to steel, from oil to iron ore. And so their prices are falling. Well, that tells you that all these economies are poised to turn into a recession. And the other story, as I recall, had something to do with the stock market, you know, being basically in a bubble state. In fact, I think it might have been about bonds, how bonds were going up and, you know, money was fleeing into bonds. And I said, you look at these things and it tells me it's time to get the hell out of the stock market. And if I had, well, I do have, if whatever retirement funds I may have or whatever, to put them into bond funds or just cash. I mean, just, you know, just park it, because these are scary times. And I think, frankly, you know, bond funds are a good thing. I'm not trying to play investment advisor here, and I don't offer investment advice on this program. That said, I suggested that the market was going to go down. Okay, that was Tuesday. Then yesterday, the market crashed, sort of. I mean, it was a flash crash. It bounced back a little bit. Today, it started down, way down. It's up a little bit, but it's still the middle of the day. And it's still, you know, the middle of the week. I mean, it's Thursday. But yesterday I asked the question, could it be that a market crash in the 3 weeks before the midterm elections is going to hurt Democrats because you've got a Democrat in the White House? And if so, could that be part of a bunch of billionaires sitting around saying, hey, you know, in addition to publishing a flyer in North Carolina telling, you know, Rachel Maddow last night was talking about this election is so close, it's close enough to steal. In addition to publishing a flyer in North Carolina, confusing voters, giving them wrong information about how to register, where to register, all that kind of stuff, as the Koch brothers, Americans for Prosperity, apparently did. What if we were to dump a couple, you know, $1 billion worth of stock Might that not crash the market? Well, anyhow, today in Real Clear Politics, here's the headline. Is falling stock market the death knell for Dems?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Once again, by James Pearson over at realclearpolitics.com. Is falling stock market the death knell for Dems? I guess I'm not a conspiracy nut. Bad, the very, very omnipotently ugly. The good. Jennifer Chomicki, the Pennsylvania mother of two, has joined up with three other parents to file a legal challenge to a dangerous decision by their town council. A decision would allow an energy company to drill for natural gas just half a mile from a local elementary school. And Chomicki and other parents are worried about the damage this will do to their kids' health. The lawsuit claims that the town council's decision was unconstitutional under Pennsylvania law. Only time will tell if the lawsuit succeeds, but it's still good to see everyday people standing up to the fossil fuel industry. Good luck, Jennifer. The bad. Debbie Donegan, Jefferson County, Missouri's recorder of deeds, now said that she meant no ill will toward President Obama after calling for his overthrow in a Facebook page last week. That post, which has since been deleted, reads as follows. Quote, I have a question for all my friends who have served or are currently serving in our military. Having not put on a uniform or taken any type of military oath, there has to be something I am just not aware of. But I cannot and do not understand why no action is being taken against our domestic enemy. I know he is supposedly the commander-in-chief, but the Constitution gives you authority. What am I missing? End of quote. I don't know, Debbie. Calling the first black president in American history a domestic enemy and asking for a military coup? Seems like the definition of ill will, but maybe that's just me. And the very, very ugly, Rush Limbaugh. The right-wing radio host has a new conspiracy theory about why Ebola has reached America. It's government and media elites who didn't do anything to stop its spread because they think Americans deserve to get Ebola. Seriously, take a listen to this clip from Tuesday's broadcast of the Rush Limbaugh Show.
Folks, please do not doubt me when I tell you we have people at the highest levels of our government, at the highest levels of our media. Okay, we got an Ebola outbreak primarily in three countries in Africa. Somebody says we got to close down our airports. We can't allow flights from those countries. People at the highest levels of our government say, why? Why shouldn't we get it? Why should only those three nations in Africa get it? We're no better than they are. And they have this attitude, well, if they have it in Africa, by God, we deserve to get it because they're in Africa because of us.
Right. Leave it to Rush to turn a conversation about public health into a fevered dream about the tyranny of political correctness and reverse racism. It is truly bizarre and very, very ugly. Cory Gardner, by the way, last night in the Colorado debate, was confronted by the moderators about his lies about a personhood bill. That was just amazing. In fact, on my TV show last night, I did the lone liberal debate with a couple of conservatives. I'm the lone liberal. And they kept insisting, Cory Gardner's not in favor of personhood, of making it so that women who have miscarriages have to call the police and report themselves. Cory Gardner's not in favor of that. Well, it turns out he is, and last night the moderator called him on it. Here's what happened.
You continue to deny that the Federal Life at Conception Act, which you sponsor, is a personhood bill to end abortion, and we are not going to debate that here tonight because it's a fact. Your co-sponsors say so, your opponents say so, and independent fact-checkers say so. So let's instead talk about what this entire episode may say about your judgment more broadly. It would seem that a charitable interpretation would be that you have a difficult time admitting when you're wrong, and a less charitable interpretation is that you're not telling us the truth. Which is it?
I think, again, I do not support the personhood amendment. The bill that you're referring to is simply a statement that I support life. But let me just repeat the words of Senator Udall.
Why does no one else think that? That's what we're getting at.
Again, I have answered this question multiple times.
I'm aware of that.
If you look at what the Denver Post said, the Denver Post has called Senator Udall's campaign on these issues, because he's a social issues warrior, obnoxious, focused on one single issue. The fact is, the people of Colorado deserve better. They deserve more than a single issue that Senator Udall is attempting to give them.
And believe you me, we're going to talk about that. But what I'm asking you about here is what appears to be the willing suspension of the facts. People who agree with you on the issue of life think you're wrong about how you're describing the bill. Everybody seems to have a cohesive idea of what this is, with the exception of you. And I'm just wondering, what should voters glean from that?
There are people who have who agree with my opinion on life. There are people who don't. I support life. I've voted for exceptions. But the fact is, the bill that you are talking about is simply a statement that I support life. Now, again, I've answered this question multiple times, but I'll repeat the words of Senator Udall, who said when he changed his position on the issue of gay marriage, that a good faith change of position should be considered a virtue, not a vice. Now, that's not my words. Those are the words from Senator Udall.
And you remain on the bill, and the idea of personhood is conferring rights of normal human beings on the unborn. I mean, that's what the bill says.
Again, I believe I support life. And
yeah, right. So Cory Gardner gets called out, and then he tries to say, I changed my position, and then they point out, no, you haven't. You're still on the bill. And he's like, oh, don't look at that. See, Cory Gardner needed a fan, right? I mean, he just had he had a fan, we wouldn't be talking about Cory Gardner screwing up. Anyway, it's a fascinating time. Matt in Seminole, Florida. Hey, speaking of your state, Matt, you watched the Florida debate?
Yeah, I watched that debate, and I also watched the debate 4 years ago, and I was listening to you this morning, a little bit ago, saying there might be a conspiracy. The thing is that Rick Scott pulled this in 2009.
How?
With Alex Zink.
How?
During one of the debates, Alex Zink pulled out his her BlackBerry to discuss, just to answer a text, and he went ballistic. And he hemmed and hawed, stopped his foot, and you're absolutely correct. What did they cover in 2009? Alex Zink broke the rules, and Rick Scott is just playing the same game here, but it's not going to get the same result.
So this is a game that Rick Scott has played in the past successfully. Wow.
Exactly.
So my wife, Louise, this morning, our senior producer, she's like, Tom, you're going to sound paranoid if you say that. And I'm like, or you're going to sound like a conspiracy nut. And I'm like, but it sure seems, you know, if I was Charlie Crist's advisor, I would be telling him to do this. And she's like, no. But you're saying, you know, he's actually successfully used this strategy in the past. That's amazing. Matt, thank you for the
Yeah.
Thank you for the heads up on that. Thank you for the information. That's astounding. We're going to have to get that written into our daily take tonight. Richard in San Antonio, Florida. Hey, Richard, you watched the Florida debate?
Yes, Tom, I did. And I must say I'm a fan of Charlie Crist. I was under the podium, I think.
Yeah.
Tom, I wanted to tell you, when I reached 62, I lost my job to attrition, and my wife was recovering from breast cancer. We had a surgery scheduled. Of course, I lost my insurance. So I went after my Florida governor to say, how can I be helped? And I received a letter that said, use your 10% discount at the primary clinics. This is from the governor's office. And then I was one of the ones battling to get on Obamacare, and I finally achieved it. But that took it was a dogfight to get on that, and there was a lot of theories that perhaps the website was being blocked and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But the one thing I'd like to address, I wish Charlie Crist would bring up in the debate, there's an outfit in Florida called the Department of Family and Children. And I applied that because I had to have an emergency surgery, and I didn't have coverage yet. And the Florida Department of Children has agreed to cover me. I said, wonderful. I had the procedure. And then I went to them in that January, and Governor Crist decided to not fund the program anymore. So
not,
I was
not fund the program anymore?
Right. I was eliminated from the program.
Wow.
And I said, but I already had the procedure under your word. And that was it. So I fought hard and more difficult. And then I finally got a letter from the Florida Department of Family and Children's saying, you were covered under Medicaid for 8 days. Didn't you know that? I said, no. How was I supposed to know? Who was going to tell me?
Wow.
You will notice one thing, Tom, in Florida, when people try to get on the Department of Children, Family and Children, to talk to them, it's virtually impossible.
Yeah.
and it's on the internet saying, how can I do so?
Well, that's the Republican strategy, is you break government and then you sit around and complain about how government is broken.
Exactly. And I walk around and I talk to colleagues, and they do believe that this Rick Scott is real. And but the thing is now I've been told to go to my medical provider, ask them to give me my money back, and then go to Medicaid to see if they can recover the money. That's Rick Scott's solution.
Oh, geez. Good luck with that. Richard, thank you very much for the call and for sharing your story. Will, in Blakesley, Pennsylvania. Will, we got a minute to the break. You wanted to talk about Rick Scott?
Hey. Hi, how are you? Yeah, they up about the possible reasons behind what happened last night. You're absolutely, there's no reason whatsoever to think that's far-fetched. Of course, the different, they do that and much worse. I think there's that's
well, the fact that Rick Scott pulled this in 2009 with Alex Sink and got away with it and successfully changed the media narrative from the content of the debate to whether or not Alex Sink pulled out a BlackBerry, that to me is pretty damning. I mean, that's like, yeah, I did not know that. And we've fact-checked it. It's true. And it seems like, Alex, yeah, here, I'll take that. I mean,
yeah, no, I think that is very well. It's actually, it's very, I would say, likely. But it also could be explained, though, simply that Rick Scott he seems to have some kind of narcissistic personality disorder. I mean, seriously, he does. And he's basically a sense of entitlement. So he may have just thrown a hissy fit.
That is true of an astounding number of people in politics. but he might have just thrown a hissy fit. But if that particular type of hissy fit got him elected governor in 2009, in 2010 functionally, then why wouldn't he try it again? We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And in fact, before Rick Scott went off on Alex Sink pulling her BlackBerry out during the debate back in 2009, they were tied. Then he pulled ahead.
Fascinating. Fascinating. First, Alex, you say you follow the rules. Scott said the rule was no one was supposed to give us messages during the break, and your campaign did with an iPad or an iPod. She fired an ad after the debate tonight. Amazing. Amazing. Marcia in Englewood, Florida. Hey, Marcia.
Hi, Tom. Can you hear me better this week?
I hear you just fine. It is breaking up a little bit.
Thanks.
It sounds, it's okay.
Oh, gosh.
So.
Anyway, I watched that debate last night, and I've written Charlie Crist a number of times saying he's missing the point on all of his advertising. He did nothing about voter. He said nothing about voter fraud that the Republicans commit. He said nothing about an issue that's on the ballot in November for a constitutional amendment for water and land conservation, the money of which has been collected for the past 20 years, but in the last 2 years, Governor Scott has saw fit to move it into the general fund.
Hmm.
So there goes our land and water management.
But it lets him say, hey, I balanced the budget.
Yeah, exactly. On the backs of the people.
Yeah, or on the backs of your wetlands.
Yeah. He talks about all the jobs that he created. If you go through the state of Florida, you will find that the highest paying jobs that he has created are in Naples, the city that needs it the least.
Right.
The other jobs, I live in Charlotte County, which is on the sort of midway between Tampa and Fort Myers. Small town. Mm-hmm. Not a great-sized county, but a very poor county.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting Burger King's. We're getting McDonald's. These are the jobs that are getting created in the state of Florida.
Walmart.
All except... Yeah, well, Walmart killed all our mom-and-pop shops.
Yep.
We got a lot of strip malls that are still vacant.
Hmm.
And little stores that try and move in and do something, they can't compete.
Yeah.
He never mentioned anything about the insurance scam that's going on down here, homeowners insurance. Every single year since Rick Scott's been in office, my homeowners insurance to rebuild my house has gone up over $300 a year,
mm-hmm.
more close to $400 a year. It's getting to the point where I got to get rid of my house just to pay homeowners, just because of homeowners insurance rates.
Wow.
Nothing said about that.
Is that because of the increasing threat of severe weather, hurricanes and things? And flooding?
I can't say that because look what's going on in the Midwest.
Yeah.
Just 2 days ago, they had 5 or 6 states get creamed.
Well, they may be having the same problem with their homeowners insurance.
Well, somebody's insuring them.
But my point is the insurance companies, they're no idiots. They're looking at global warming and you know, constantly jacking insurance rates up to respond to it.
That's another issue. I think this issue is what I wanted to talk to you about last week. Why isn't the insurance company coming out in defense of global warming?
Or you mean in opposition to global warming? They have. Swiss Re, the largest reinsurance company in the world, has done that many times. Oh, Danielle, who used to live in Florida, says it's because they have no state income tax. They made up the money through property taxes. That makes sense, too. Thank you, Danielle. Marcia, thanks for the call. We'll be right back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Alex Sink, the Democratic candidate for Florida governor, participates in a debate against Republican challenger Rick Scott at Nova University in Davie, Florida, Wednesday, October 20th, 2010. I guess it wasn't 2009, it was 2010. And here's the, this is by Lucy Madison, CBS News. Florida gubernatorial candidate Alex Sink, a Democrat, was caught violating the terms of a debate with Republican opponent Rick Scott on Monday after she was seen reading a text message sent by an aide. And during the commercial break, Sink's makeup artist showed the candidate a two-sentence conversation message on a Droid cell phone sent from an advisor directing her to a point of conversation, and Rick Scott went nuts. And afterwards, Alex Sink fired the aide, said, you broke the rules, you shouldn't have done this, and that's all anybody talked about, and they were neck and neck at that point, and Rick Scott pulled out ahead as a result of that. Very interesting. He's trying the same old playbook. Taylor in San Jose, California. You want to talk about Republicans?
Yes. Today you mentioned Republicans being the party of special interests and the Democrats being the party of the people. And I'll tie it into yesterday. You were talking about how a lot of the progressive views are very popular with the people. Here in California, they've picked up on that. All the we have a couple props for different things, for a insurance commission to reject high rate increases, and the insurance companies are outspending $37 million to about $6 million. And in all of their ads, which are on the radio every 5 seconds, they claim that the politician that would reject the insurance increases has special interest on his side or their side.
Hmm.
So they're using that argument against the Democrats, against the liberal positions.
Right. This is classic Republican politics and classic dirty politics, let's say. And that is accuse the other guy of doing what you yourself are doing. And it makes it much harder for the other guy to accuse you of doing it because you accused him first. Fascinating. Taylor, thanks for the heads up on that. John in Aurora, Illinois, you wanted to talk about Ebola and Reagan?
Yeah. Tom, I've been listening to you for 3 months on DirecTV.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is that you totally changed my mind about Reagan. I used to believe like he was like God or something,
mm-hmm.
And now I sort of like started to believe that he's only human.
Well, I think it goes beyond that. He was one of the worst presidents in the history of the United States. More senior administration officials were successfully prosecuted. Crimes during the Reagan presidency than any other presidency in the history of the United States, which means he had the most corrupt presidency in history.
And I'm starting to believe that and everything like that.
That's a point of fact.
I believe that, and I've seen the previous for Kill the Messenger and everything like that.
Yeah.
And I want to tie this to Ebola on this fact. The Republicans are like, I just don't get it. They just like want to like fearmonger or panic marker. I've watched Fox News and like it's like everything. I don't know. I get
They will take anything and turn it into an opportunity to trash President Obama. It's or Democrats in general. It's really simple. Bunnies. Oh, look at bunnies. Must be something bad going on in the White House. Right? It's like you can come up with the most innocuous stuff, and whatever it is, that the Republicans are going to figure out some way to use it to trash Democrats. It's pretty astounding. John, thank you for the call, and keep up the serious thinking there. Quentin in Palestine, Texas, the city that the Columbia disintegrated over the top of, didn't it, back in the day?
Yes, sir. We've also got Adrian Peterson, please.
Uh-huh.
I was under the impression, and I'm sure Governor Scott was too, that Mr. Crist was hiding an admirer underneath his podium.
Yeah, it was kind of pitched that way originally. You know, he had a fan on stage.
Acolyte.
Yeah.
But I called concerning the flag burning. Contributing money to campaigns is a constitutionally protected right in exactly the same way as flag burning is. In fact, if I so choose, I can pile up 1 million American flags and set them on fire. Constitutionally protected. Now, that would then constitute a public hazard, and would be stopped because, it could set the town on fire.
Right.
So that's what these oligarchs are doing. They're creating a hazard to our democracy.
Yeah, so you're basically making my case of yesterday that I was saying money is power. I like that construct. I think it works well at law as well as
at
logic.
Yeah, I can pile up a million flags and set them on fire.
Yeah, but your construct or your frame is that it's a hazard, a moral or political or small d democratic hazard. Enormous amounts of money in politics.
Yelling fire in a crowded movie house.
Yeah, I'm with you, Quentin. Thanks a lot for the call, Helen in Ithaca, New York. Hey, Helen, what's up? Thanks for listening to 1470 AM.
Hi. Good afternoon, Tom. I was wondering what you thought of. I've been hearing a lot of progressive or whatever you want to call it, friends of mine, criticizing Obama for the way he's been handling the Ebola virus.
Well, he hasn't been handling it. The hospital in Texas has been handling
CDC,
it.
Yeah, that guy screwed up, you know. But I mean, he had regulatory agencies and cabinet members meeting with him. He spent over 2 hours with them. They actually use the language. I don't know if it was what's his name, Josh
Ernst,
the new press secretary guy. Yeah,
Ernest.
You know, they use the word SWAT team. Next time we see a case, we're going down there. You know, so I'm like, what more is he supposed to do? But everyone's going no, he should.
Here's the irony of it, Helen. The very same Republicans who tell you that government can't do anything right, government should get out of the way, government should deregulate, government should not be involved in the decisions of the private enterprise of hospitals, are now screaming that Obama has not inserted government into the private decisions of hospitals, that Obama has not established national standards for treating Ebola. That Obama has not done enough. The very same Republicans who scream every time he does anything. And it proves my point that, he can do nothing right. Thank you, Helen, for the call. He can do nothing right in their minds. And like I said, they'd say, oh, bunnies, it must be Obama's fault. Apple pie, terrible.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. While Congress is doing their bread and circus routine, grilling the CDC chief, Nina Pham, I believe her name is being transferred here to the D.C. area, to the National Institutes of Health, get her out of that Texas hospital. Not sure exactly why. Presumably it's because there's better care. I'm also wondering if maybe in the hospital in Texas people are just saying, hey, Ebola, I'm not going near it after what's happened. So let's ask Roseanne DeMauro, the executive director of National Nurses United. NationalNursesUnited.org is the website. Roseanne, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Thank you for having me on.
It's always great talking with you.
You know, you guys, by the way, I do want to thank you for the coverage you've been giving this. So it's good.
You're welcome. And I think it's, you know, it's we have talked on this program about how the lack of unions in Texas puts all workers at risk. Here is, you know, hyper case in point. Texas is a right to work for less state.
Absolutely.
You know, they aggressively trash unions. We've got a so-called not-for-profit hospital here that's actually funded by a company that is funded by a vulture capital firm, you know, a Mitt Romney kind of firm. And last year they showed an 8.3%. They call it a fund balance, but it's actually a profit, which is higher than their 7% profit from the previous year. Yeah, I mean, there's just what's going on down in Texas. What is it that we need to know about what's happening?
Well, you know, I think I have to kind of disaggregate the two. What's happening in the Dallas hospital could have actually been any hospital in this country, because we have essentially vacated any notion of a healthcare system in favor of a market-based healthcare industry. excuse me, Tom. And we're seeing the direct effects of that. I mean, the status quo is indefensible if it puts people's lives at risk, and that's what we have, and that's what we're unable to move our legislators from so far. I mean, every day we have nurses, you know, we had nurses in Texas come forward. They came forward anonymously because they were very fearful for their jobs. So your point on the unions is 100% accurate. They were so afraid when they were talking to us, they were trembling. But their story was so compelling in terms of everything that went wrong. What was particularly, I'd say, the most kind of outrageous thing was that there were no protocols in place in that hospital, and yet they tried to blame the nurse that had contracted Ebola for not following protocol. So what happened after that was we held an informational press conference that said don't blame nurses. The nurses saw that from the National Nurses United, and they called us, and they wanted to talk because they could not take the fact that they were being blamed for what was the most chaotic, just complete void of any type of actual procedures and policies and protocols that should have been in place. But I am telling you, that could be any hospital in this country. And that's what we're hearing from nurses across the nation, and we're hearing it loudly. I mean, we had a conference call yesterday. We had 11,500 nurses on that call looking for answers. That shouldn't be the responsibility of the nurses. That should be policy in this country.
Right. In other words, we are the only developed country in the world that does not have a national health care system.
Absolutely. And it's indefensible because it kills people.
Yeah.
And that's what we saw. I mean, just flat out, that's what we've seen. You know, this is the policymakers are dragging their feet. And I'll tell you, it's a bipartisan thing. It's not, you know, every day the CDC, because of the pressure, where the nurses in the country are ramping up. You know, the nurses are the vocal voice on this.
Yeah.
Because of the pressure of the nurses, the CDC and the Obama administration have to keep, you know, restating different protocols. They should go to the precautionary principle. They should have, you know, do no harm as their first principle, and have protection for these healthcare providers who could possibly infect other people if they become infected.
Right.
This is outrageous. And you know what? The wealthy are not going to escape this one, Tom. They're not going to escape this one. Because
yeah.
I don't, you know, defunding the healthcare system and thinking that they were somehow immune, that is going to blow up. And what's really, I'm sorry, I know this sounds like a rant, but I am really upset about this. This young woman is 26 years old, single young woman, has a dog, works hard, comes home, right? She's trying to take care of her life. She contracts Ebola. She's trying very hard to take care of Mr. Duncan that died.
Yeah.
Then you turn around, and if this were a CEO, if this were a legislator, if this were a movie star, they would have changed protocols immediately. But it was only a nurse, only a nurse.
Right. And this, in fact, I think that, you know, nursing is a profession that is pretty much dominated by women and is by and large viewed as subordinate to doctors. In fact, I discovered when our oldest daughter got her PhD in nursing that, I don't know if this is Oregon law or federal law or whatever, but she cannot refer to herself as Dr. Hartman because the doctors don't allow a nurse with a PhD. Now, a person who has a PhD in psychology can call themselves Dr. Hartman, but not somebody with a PhD in nursing, which blows my mind. So anyhow, what we're seeing is that, what we saw was that when Duncan showed up in the ER, it was the triage nurse who was blamed. Nobody talked about the doctor. The administration of the hospital was never blamed. And then when a nurse gets sick, it's that nurse broke protocol. Then we discover there's no protocols. Now we've got a second, and there's just massive blame the victim here.
It's unconscionable. It was chaotic. And these nurses that were basically told, to figure it out themselves. They don't control the budget. They don't control the physicians. They don't control the administration. They don't even get to order supplies, or they would probably want to have protection for themselves, I would say. So here's a situation where these young nurses were doing their job. They're humanists. You know how beautiful nurses are. I mean, they're beautiful people.
I do.
And, you know,
I have one in the family.
And they're put on the front lines without the proper equipment. I mean, part of the thing that, you know, I said in my letter yesterday to the president, demanding that they issue an executive order like they do when they're sending people off to war today, an executive order to protect our nurses with the optimal standards by the standards of the Nebraska Medical Center, University of Nebraska. And what happened today is very funny. What's happened today, he's being responsive I would say that this is undoubtedly coming from the Obama administration, the hospital administrators. They're putting these kind of faux nurse groups on television to quell fears and act like everything's okay. Everything is not okay.
Right.
It's not going to be okay until our frontline people are protected from this virus, and they're able to protect this country.
And not just this virus. There's a whole bunch of zoonotic viruses out there. There's flu out there. There's the potential for the return of the 1918 flu. There's smallpox could pop back up again. I mean, there's all kinds of things out there that are potential threats that are good reasons to have a national healthcare system. You pointed out, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, in an interview yesterday, that the lever, and we have just a minute left here, that the lever that the president could use to demand national standards is if you as a hospital intend to take Medicare or Medicaid money, you must meet these standards. Is that
precisely? Precisely. Okay. That's his lever. He should have more levers. He should have a healthcare czar that can actually dictate safety measures to hospitals. But it's an industry. It's not a system.
Right.
These are for-profit competing sectors that essentially are about money. And the nurses are about patients, and we have a conflict like I've never seen in history.
Yeah, and this is the kind of lever that, for example, Jimmy Carter used. You want federal highway funds? Lower your speed limit to save, to conserve fuel during the crisis. It would be basically doing the same thing. Any feedback from the administration about whether they're considering that?
Yesterday the president canceled two of his trips, and his quote last night was he's going to push out communications. You know, our president's a great pragmatist, and the problem is that the wealthy sector eats him alive.
He needs to push out orders.
How about pushing out mandates, pushing out directives?
There you go. Roseanne, tomorrow, I'm sorry we're out of time, but at nationalnursesunited.org is the website. The executive director of National Nurses United, Roseanne tomorrow, you are doing God's work, Roseanne. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Bye.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And be sure to check out National Nurses United. It's a great organization. We'll be right back, 15 minutes past the hour. That's interesting. Shane just pointed out to me that John Roberts, this is the Supreme Court decision that drilled a hole in Obamacare that said that states can choose to take or not take Medicaid funding. And it was
basically you have to take Medicaid funding. It's part of Obamacare. And, yeah, otherwise you'd lose all your Medicaid funding. So maybe if Roseanne's solution was used by President Obama, the Supreme Court would step in and stop him. That would be pretty bizarre. But there's actually precedent for that. Amazing. John in Cayucos, California. Hey, John, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. What's up?
Sure, Tom. How you doing? Hey, if I was Charlie Crist, I'll keep this real short because it's pretty trite. I would have argued with the Rick Scott people that my fan is not an electronic device. It's actually an electrical appliance. It has no electronics.
I think that is the argument that they made. I'm not sure that they ever even tried to fight that battle. The rules say you can't have an electronic device on the podium. The reason why is obvious. And in fact, this is the song and dance that Rick Scott did back in 2010 against Alex Sink. And
that's amazing.
Yeah, it is. I was astounded when the citizen of Florida called up and said, hey, this is nothing new. Because I've been thinking, this is just a little too contrived, It's just a little too slick.
Yeah, I agree.
And the other thing I noticed was, and I pointed this out to Louise last night, as this was happening, and they were reporting it on CNN or MSNBC or whatever we happened to be watching at the time, we channel surf in the evenings, might even have been Fox, the Fangate hashtag was trending on Twitter, and I thought, wow, I wonder if Rick Scott's campaign is behind that Fangate hashtag, pushing that thing out. So,
right.
Who knows?
It wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me either. John, thanks for calling and making the point. It's an excellent one. John, Mike in Palmer, Alaska. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV.
You bet. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I just wonder, what is it going to take to wake up the majority of the American people that are listening to this show? And I'm sure most of them are already awake. But the fact remains, if a nurse can't trust a doctor, and a doctor can't trust a nurse, what is the point of having a hospital open?
Right.
What is the deal here? Are they trying to just, eradicate all of the people that can't afford health care?
Yeah.
Or what? Is there some sort of a...
I think the sad commentary on this, Mike, is that this conversation about a national health care system and national standards and stuff and how the whole rest of the world has it will not be held on commercial television. And the reason why is that the five big corporations who own virtually all of commercial television in America, including virtually all the programs you see on cable, those five corporations have interlocking boards of directors and very similar interests and worldviews with the big corporations that run the healthcare industry, the multi-billion-dollar industry, the corporations that run the hospitals across the country, the pharmaceutical companies, who, by the way, advertise on these television networks, and the health insurance companies who advertise on the networks. So that's why we're not going to have that conversation anywhere other than on a program like this where the host actually owns the show. Mike, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back 20 minutes past the hour. It's the program where we dare to ask, is Hobby Lobby a person? And we dare to say, no, Hobby Lobby is not a person. John Roberts and his buddies, his four other right-wing cranks on the Supreme Court, are just plain old flat-out wrong. We also dare to say a lot of other things in this program. But did Charlie Crist just punk the entire media of the United States? Based on what he did in October of 2010, did he just punk all of us? Excuse me, I said Charlie Crist. I meant Rick Scott. I'm constantly mixing the guys up. Did Rick Scott just punk us all by doing in this debate with Charlie Crist the exact same thing he did with Alex Sink back in October of 2010, which is saying, oh, you've got an electronic device. That's you're breaking the rules. You're cheating. I'm debating a cheater. And people are much more horrified by somebody being a cheater, which is really weird because Rick Scott, cheated everybody in Florida in this billion-dollar Medicaid fraud and Medicare fraud. when he was the president of HCA. But, you know, he's saying, oh, yeah, Alex Sink was a cheater. Now he's saying, Charlie Crist is a cheater. Give me a break. Tom in Oak Park, Illinois, listening on WCPT. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I was listening to your interview yesterday with Gail Trotter.
Yeah.
I don't get to catch up on you all that much, but there were a couple of things that she said which really, really just caught my attention, and it was her phrasing and the words that she used. When she said that the Citizens United case and everything like that helped to, and I'm paraphrasing here so you can help me a little bit, she used the phrase, it increased the marketplace of ideas.
Yeah, it's a lifted phrase from the majority opinion in Citizens United.
I think that really, really pointed out exactly the fact that they now think that laws and politicians are commodities.
Yeah,
I have no problem with the marketplace of ideas when you're trying to sell something such as ketchup or diapers or cars or refrigerators, because that you're advertising, you're encouraging somebody to buy. But when it comes to laws, laws are not something to be bought and sold. And also, if you go into, you adhere to the phrase, the marketplace of ideas, what you're saying is that those who have money are more entitled the ideas than those who don't, and that goes against the very, very heart of democracy.
Yeah. I'm with you, Tom. I think that your point is very well taken, and it's the argument. And I encourage you to read. It's not particularly long. I think it's 5-6 pages long, maybe a little longer than that. The Citizens United dissent that was penned by John Paul Stevens, because it is astonishing. He calls out his colleagues. He basically, you know, he flays Antonin Scalia and John Roberts. It's really remarkable. Although, you know, it's been 4 years. I think relitigating Citizens United right now is, you know, a bit of a challenge. But I'm with you. I'm totally with you. Tom, thank you for the call. David in Berkeley, California. Hey, David, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Sorry, first time caller. I've been listening for a few months and
thank you.
Really like the show. I just wanted to ask you, with all the scare fear-mongering with Ebola, if you happened to see Shep Smith's reporting on it.
I did not, but I did see three different headlines this morning in, by and large, progressive or left-wing media, and also, I think, over on Media Matters, calling him out and congratulating him for saying, hey, you know, let's not get hysterical on this. Let's not just pump this thing for ratings. Unfortunately, the computer that I have here at my workstation doesn't have audio on it, so I didn't have time to listen to it.
Oh, it was pretty powerful, especially coming from the heart of the beast.
Yeah,
Fox News.
Shepard Smith is kind of the one lone voice of reason over at Fox News, and you wonder if he's the token voice of reason or if they're. I don't know. I'm curious what kind of audience he's caught and how loyal and committed Fox News viewers are to him.
I'm just wondering if he's going to be back. No, I'm just kidding. But
no, you just never know.
I just wanted to see your opinion on that. Also, for your viewers, I actually saw a documentary last night on Netflix that you were in, and I recommend it to all your viewers, called I Am.
Oh, yeah. It's on Netflix now. Tom Shadyac's movie.
Exactly. It's a great documentary. I think all your viewers should watch it.
Yeah, it really is. Is it free on Netflix?
If you have a Netflix subscription,
watch it. Yeah, pretty much everything is free on Netflix, isn't it? Well, that's great. I didn't know that. Yeah, I was interviewed for that a couple of years ago. It came out last year. It was brilliant. Tom Shadyac was the guy who made Bruce Almighty and all these other movies with what's his name in them. And, Jim Carrey. He basically made Jim Carrey famous as a producer and director. And then he had an accident, a bike accident, and he thought he was going to die. And he really reevaluated his life and decided to sell the mansion and downscale. He lives in a mobile home now on the seacoast. I mean, it's a nice mobile home park, but he really radically downsized. And he made a movie about it and interviewed me for the movie. And it's a really, really thoughtful movie about what is the meaning of life? What are we all doing here? It's called I Am. Tom Shadyac is the director. And it's great that it's on Netflix. David, thanks for the call and thanks for the heads up and thanks for the kind words. It's 28 minutes past the hour. We'll be back in just a few minutes with more of your calls and more of my thoughts. There is more in the news of the day as well. And we will be getting into some of those items as we move along. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
In fact, I wanted to share with you a Financial Times piece about employees who are good at getting things done. After the break, we'll pick up your calls. I found this absolutely fascinating. Welcome back to the program. Exposing the con and conservative. Tom Hartman here with you. And this is very off the point of politics, but it's a point that I just, it so struck me, it so resonated with me in my life experience. I wanted to share it with you. Lucy Kellaway was writing in the Financial Times on October 12th. I printed this out, what would that be, Monday? I guess it was. Anyhow, it was earlier in the week. Because I thought, this is such a good piece. The title of it is Wanted, Employees Who Are Good at Getting Things Done. And I just want to make this point as somebody who has both been an employee and an employer, and mostly an employer throughout my life. Probably 90% of my working life I have been an employer, although I've also been an employee in as much as Louise and I started business after business after business where we worked for nothing for years and, you know, put our own savings into things and those kind of, and built these various businesses, one of them being this program. And I remember when I was 20 years old, I took a Dale Carnegie course because I wanted to learn how to give a speech. It was a course in public speaking. And I, to this day, I recommend it to anybody. It was one of the most useful and powerful and transformational experiences I ever had in my life. And I think it's in the fifth week, but it might not, might be the seventh week. In any case, at one point in the Dale Carnegie course, you have to stand up in front of the room and say this: I know men in the ranks who will stay in the ranks. Why? I'll tell you why. Simply because they don't know how to get things done. And it was all an exercise in how to be emphatic. To pound you. Simply because they don't know how to get things done. But the reality is that the vast majority of people in the workplace, in my experience, don't know how to get things done. Or don't care. Or don't feel committed. Or, you know, whatever. I mean, it's just, mediocrity is just wild. And I have always been, this is something Louise and I as employers, I mean, we always look for. And we have, here in the radio show with Jim and Shane and Danielle and Troy, people who are absolutely committed to getting things done. And you know, you say, can you do this job? Yes, I can do that job in 10% more, 20% more, 100% more. It's so incredible. It's so important. And it's the way I've always conducted myself. And so I really honor it. And this article points out, they did this survey of employers. And this is the University of Washington University in St. Louis. 5 years studying this. And what they found was, first of all, that employers rate conscientiousness, in other words, commitment to getting things done, as the most important job characteristic. You look at LinkedIn, you know, where people list, you know, it's basically, here's my resume, here's all the stuff I'm good at. And people say, I have people skills. Right? Here's a note. On LinkedIn in the UK, only 92,000 of their 15 million members admit to being conscientious. But 12 million of the 15 million say they have people skills. You know, and Danielle says, and Sean and Sue and Nigel, too. Yes, Sean and Sue and Nigel and everybody else who's working on this program. They're all 110%, 150%, 200% people. And I think it shows in the work that we do. So just a heads up, you know, something to tell your kids, something to note for yourself. They also noted that people who have conscientious spouses tend to be more conscientious. When Louise and I were parenting, and please don't tell our kids this, but when Louise and I were parenting, we figured out, we actually, a fellow by the name of Kemis Wilson, who used to publish, started Entrepreneur Magazine, as I recall, and was a famous American entrepreneur. He became a good friend of ours. And he said, he pointed out to us some really good research that, indicated that your children's peers have more influence, their friends have more influence on them than you do as parents. So as parents, rather than trying to influence our children, although, you know, obviously you do that, but we've always been pretty aggressive in not giving our kids advice unless it's asked for. But what we did do is we did whatever we could to help pick friends, to help pick their friends. In other words, if there were friends that we thought were going to be supportive and helpful and help build character and make our kids better people, we would go out of our way to say, you know, if you want to go to the movies with that person, if you want to go to the mall with that person, if you want to go out, you know, if that person wants to spend the night here, whatever, we would go out of our way to make it easy and convenient. We'll drive you around. We'll do whatever it takes. On the other hand, if it was somebody who we thought was going to bring down our kids, somebody who was not conscientious, somebody who was not a good role model, we'd never said no. But, you know, that day I was too busy to drive them to the mall together, or Louise really didn't have the time to take them to the movies. And so our kids all turned out really well. I don't know if this had anything to do with it, but the same thing is true of, it turns out, according to this research, and I refer you to this piece by Lucy Calloway, Wanted: Employees Who Are Good at Getting Things Done, that she notes, a conscientious spouse is more likely to remember to take the rubbish out and make sure there's something for supper. If you marry someone like this, you don't have to get entirely bogged down in such things yourself. Second, they set a great example. If they are organized and punctual and diligent, all those unfashionable but utterly wonderful things that conscientious people always are, it helps you to be so too. My wife is extremely conscientious and has had an incredibly positive influence on me. And third, if you were smart enough to marry someone like this, your home will be a well-oiled machine, which means that you're going to turn up at work considerably less stressed than colleagues who arrive from a hearth that is chaotic. Now, there's a certain kind of little sexist edge to that, I suppose, but I just wanted to toss it out there. We don't need to have a big conversation about it. It's just one of those things that every now and then I something flies by and I go, wow, you know, that's really important. It falls into the category of, why don't they, in public school in the United States, why don't they teach how to change a baby's diaper and how to balance a checkbook? Everybody does these things. Well, not everybody, but, you know, most people do them and they're not prepared for them. Why don't they teach this stuff? Anyway, this I think is also one of those things. Everybody should take a Dale Carnegie course. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's up?
Yeah, I just wanted to talk about healthcare. You know, the actual outcomes of, for public systems or socialized systems as opposed to private systems, the evidence has been clear that almost on every indice, public healthcare systems do much better at a cheaper cost. But that's taken off the table, and it has been probably since, I would imagine, for years, for over 30 years, since Reaganomics, since 1980 or so. And, you know, we have, you know, the facts are in, but, you know, they have a way, I guess, the Republicans, of avoiding the facts. But, you know, this might be an opportunity to revisit these discussions and point that out, because they're not going to be able to hide from a pandemic that might, you know.
Yeah, I'm with you. There's a couple important points with regard to this, John, and I totally agree with you. I see Jan Schakowsky right now is on TV. She's one of the really great members of the Progressive Caucus and the U.S. House of Representatives who's willing to speak the truth on this. But here's the thing. I didn't want to interrupt her, so I didn't, and I don't think I made this point when Roseanne DeMauro was on from National Nurses United. But Republicans, if you say we need a national health care system, they start screaming big government, socialism, whatnot. Democrats are, many Democrats, the Progressive Caucus has no qualms about this at all, and they've worked with National Nurses United for years. But the corporate Democrats are afraid to talk about a national health care system or a single-payer health care system or Medicare for all or any of those things because they're afraid of being called socialists. And it's a crime because, as you correctly point out, John, not only do we know from the, you know, if you just compare the health outcomes in the United States to the other 30 some odd OECD countries, the most developed countries in the world, not only do we know
that a national healthcare system produces a better outcome than a privatized healthcare system. We have known it since the 1890s, when in the late 1880s or early 1890s, Germany instituted the first national healthcare system. That's over 100 years ago. We have known this for a century. There is massive evidence to back this up. This is not a radical idea or a new idea. And yet, as you correctly point out, the Republicans have made it toxic to even talk about, which just astonishes me.
Can I make one more point?
You may.
Oh, okay. Yeah, also, I would imagine that every decision that was made at that Presbyterian hospital took into account money over the outcome, the best outcome or the best thing to do. Yeah. And I work in healthcare, and it's like that all the time. We have to battle to have a proper amount of supplies. We have to battle to do things, you know, to have more nurses per patient. It's an absolute struggle, and the nurses here are unionized, but we do not have a law that, you know, stipulates a nurse to patient ratio. And I've worked in here in Minnesota for 22 years, and I would say that the nurse to patient ratio has really gotten much worse, because of course that's how you make money.
Yeah, and it's the same with teacher student ratios, and then to a certain extent that has been driven by the privatization of our schools as well. John, excellent points all. Thank you for calling and making them. We'll be back 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So where do we go from here? And how do we get people to talk about what Chris and Scott actually talked about? And welcome back. Frank, watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite in Elkton, Maryland. Hey, Frank, you want to talk about Ebola?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Tom. Love your show. I'd like to make a comparison. I worked in the chemical industry for about 38 years, and I've wore protective suits. Some we call them bullard suits. And
what
we
suits?
We actually had what was a bullard.
B-U-L-L-A-R-D?
Yes, sir.
Huh. Is that the inventor of them or something?
That was the name of the company who made them.
Yeah. Huh.
Much like what you see like on... That's the same thing that these people did dealing with the Ebola.
The moon suits.
But anyway, we had what was called a gherkin shower. So when we were leaving the work area, we would go through a gherkin shower. Now, in our case, we had one that blew just air. We also had one that had a disinfected detergent.
Hmm.
And it was much like a human going into a car wash.
Yeah.
You would get washed off, rinsed, it would dry you. And then before we were able to leave the plant, we actually had to take a shower before we could put our street clothes on.
Wow.
And we were required to, we took blood tests. We had SOPs that were redundant, and we did that for a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you build the redundancy, and that's how you protect yourself.
Yeah. Yeah.
And one of the things we did, like I said, we took blood tests, but the attitude we had in the company I worked for, and thank God that they were this way, but we trained and we trained, and they said, we're going to train and we're going to train again.
Yeah.
And I hope the CDC, they learn something about this, because I have one big fear. It looks like we can fight this Ebola.
Oh, yeah.
I'm worried about what the next virus coming down the pike might be.
Yeah, it's going to be a whole different game if it's the 1918 flu, for example, or if it's smallpox. I mean, Ebola is fairly easily contained. As much difficulty as this hospital is having in Texas, Ebola is still fairly easily contained compared to viruses that are naturally airborne. I mean, flu, the reservoir for flu, the flu is a zoonotic disease. Most people don't realize it's a disease we get from animals. And the reason that it comes at a certain time every year has to do with the migration of geese. It's typically waterfowl, geese and ducks, that bring flu. And, you know, transport it from place to place. And it's one of the things that they track when they're trying to come up with, you know, what flu virus are we going to need to do. But the virus mutates inside the geese, doesn't make them sick. So they're reservoir animals. And you know, if the 1918 flu comes out, we got a serious, serious problem. So, you know,
and I live in a perfect environment for that, because I'm about 5 miles from the Chesapeake Bay. I'm right on the Elk River.
Yeah.
And we do see problems with flu, and And we have more geese than what we can deal with around here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the geese, they fly over an area, they poop in the grass, somebody walks in the grass, boom, the flu is all over the place. This is how flu spreads or initiates the spread. You know, and then once it's in a person, it just jumps from person to person to person. And I'm with you. If we don't have any kind of a national healthcare system that can deal with something that is fairly easily contained like Ebola, what's it going to be like if we have the Spanish flu return? What's it going to be like if smallpox comes back now that there's an entire two generations of Americans who are not immunized against smallpox? And the virus is out there, actually. So, Frank, thanks a lot for the call. Your point is very, very well taken. And if we've learned how to do this in the chemical industry, we should be able to do this in medicine. Ellen Ratner with us with the Talk Radio News Service right after this. Welcome back. Tom Harmon here with you, fair and only slightly unbalanced. Let's check in with Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. Ellen, it's so nice to have your smiling
Thank
face
you.
Right here in the studio.
I
with
am
me.
Always unbalanced. Okay, let me just go with some two quick ones before we go to Ebola.
Okay.
John Pistol is how he actually pronounced his name. He's head of the TSA, and he's resigning today. We don't know why. There was some talk, of course, that he had these scanners that revealed too much, and he got into some trouble around that. But that was a while ago, so not sure what that's
Might
about.
Might just be time to move on, too.
Right. Also, Michelle Bachmann yesterday was at the Heritage Foundation.
Oh, my.
And
next door.
Her great quote was, yeah, they own the building we're in. If you took every other country in the world and you took the number of people they allow through immigration and you added up every other country in the world, every other country in the world, together doesn't equal what the United States allows in legal immigration. Well, we allow 1 million people every year, and there's 3 million immigrants across the world that come into country. So her facts were just wrong.
Yeah.
Why am I not surprised? Okay. So let's talk about Ebola. First of all, I want to make an opening statement, which is Ebola is very deadly. There is no question about how deadly it is. But in the presses looking at Ebola and everybody else looking at Ebola, we are not looking at things like Chikungunya virus, which is in Grenada and all I know because I'm in Grenada, but it's all over the Caribbean. I don't think there's one.
This is a mosquito-borne virus.
It's a mosquito-borne virus. It is for people 40, 45 plus. The symptoms do not go away very quickly. I mean, the virus goes, the fever and all that goes away, but you're feeling like not too well for a couple of years.
Wow.
There are 750,000 people infected. There were 113 deaths of people who had chick, but it wasn't necessarily because of chick that they died. They may have had other things and then had chick. But we know that 113 people in the Caribbean.
Wow.
And
we had 30,000 people last year die from flu.
And you don't hear a word about it.
Yeah.
So, but today there was a hearing. There is a hearing. It's still going on in Congress, a joint session. And it's interesting, of course, it's very political in some respects because it has been, some of the Republicans have said, well, I'm greatly concerned that the administration did not act fast enough when responding in Texas. The trust and credibility of the administration, said Tim Murphy of Pennsylvania, et cetera. I will say this, that I was at a group of nurses' meeting in town. It's one of the honor societies meeting in town. So I had a chance to meet with some of these nurses off the record. And they are very concerned that the response was not anticipated, and the CDC did not anticipate what was going on and did not have a response ready in time.
Right.
And then that is what the nurses are saying. Now, do you blame Obama for that? No. Obama can't control everything. He's not God. I mean, he's the president of the United States. He doesn't control every agency with a million employees in this country.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay. So then Henry Waxman, who, as you know, is retiring at the end of this year, very bright man, has been involved in everything from AIDS in the 80s to now. He basically said that the budget sequestration has really gotten in the way of the CDC and others having been prepared. He said that in real dollars, the CDC budget went down 12%. There's been some debate about that, but his numbers tend to be pretty correct. He said that the hospital in Texas did not meet the standards, and he said, we can stop flights, but a lot of good that's going to do. People will just go through Brussels as that that other person did.
Yeah,
in his wisdom, and he was never my favorite press secretary, I have to admit, Jay Carney called for a travel ban. You know,
is Jay Carney Bush's guy?
No, he was Obama's guy before this, right? Then they went to work for CNN.
Well, if they're going to have a travel ban, it should start with DFW Airport. I'm serious.
All right.
I mean, how many, you know, you've had a person infected with Ebola has taken three flights through DFW. You had Thomas Duncan come in, and
right.
you had this nurse go
Cleveland,
in and out.
Ohio,
right.
Cleveland, Ohio, my hometown.
Yeah.
I'll be flying in there later today. Okay. Yeah. Also, because of contacts, an Akron school is closing, and I believe a Texas school is closing because of that, just to be sure.
Wow.
Now, so then there were several people today. Of course, the head of the CDC was there. He said that they did exit screening on people. There were 74 people that have had a fever. No one that they did exit screening on so far has had Ebola. They don't think it will. He said they have to increase awareness of physicians. One thing they have done is gotten to do it so that lab tests don't have to be taken right down to the CDC. They can be done at other places, and that the CDC is now sending emergency response teams to go to hospitals. Then Tony Fauci, veteran of AIDS, runs allergy and infectious diseases at NIH. I've known him for years. He said that this is just as bad as bioterrorism, and we have to be really on the lookout for it. He said there is product development in the pipeline. He said that there are therapeutic interventions. They're all experimental. They don't know whether they could cause harm in the long run, whether it's positive, but they are using it. The ZMAP, they are also working with, and we heard this from Dr. Robin Robinson from Health and Human Services, that they are trying to work with companies so that if the vaccine works, that they can just push it through.
Mm-hmm.
So that's happening. They also, and by the way, Bernie Sanders, Senator Bernie Sanders, and also, you just pointed me something. Maiden Kennedy Ebola victim test on healthy humans.
Vaccine.
They're ahead of us.
They are already at the point of doing clinical trials on this.
Well, there are three clinical trials actually going on in the United States and Africa, mainly in Africa, phase one trials on the vaccine. Also today, sort of related but not related, Senator Sanders and Congressman Cummings are after the drug manufacturers for saying that the price of drugs that are not under the patent, in other words, generic drugs, have increased dramatically, and they want the drug companies to explain why.
I can explain why. Because the drug companies have been buying the generic companies. The generic companies used to compete with the brand name companies, and there have been four or five major acquisitions in the last couple of years.
One last one, Nina Pham, I guess is how she pronounced her name. She's going to NIH today.
Right. She's coming to Bethesda. That's right.
Right.
Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Always great having you. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. And an amazing study came out of PRWatch.org yesterday, the Center for Media and Democracy. It was so striking. I wanted to immediately, let's get Lisa Graves on to talk about this. She's the executive director of the Center for Media and Democracy, PRWatch.org. Lisa, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having us on.
Tell me about, it's pay to pray, but P-R-E-Y, as in a predator preying on a person. Tell me about this.
This is a new report that my organization has compiled and done additional research on about how some of these governors across the country have been advancing the agenda of the American Legislative Exchange Council and some of the big corporations that are looking to get their hand in the till of our tax dollars by outsourcing or privatizing government services to for-profit firms. And so what we've done is take a look at governors in a number of states, including Wisconsin and Florida, Maine, Ohio, Michigan, and see what the real record of this privatization frenzy is. And we've shown that it really ends up being a bad deal for taxpayers.
So I read parts of your report, and I read all the excerpts that were in your press release as well. And it seems to me that this is something that is largely happening in Republican-controlled states. Is that too partisan in an analysis?
No, in fact, it is happening across the country, in states across the country, in part because there's this sort of there's this mantra that business knows best, despite what we've experienced with the meltdown of Wall Street and numerous other instances of corporate fraud and abuse. But while there are bipartisan supporters for some efforts to privatize, what we've seen is privatization on steroids in states led by governors who are advancing the ALEC agenda, or governors who have legislatures that are led by or have a majority of ALEC members in them. And so what you see is sort of the Tea Party Republicans, the Republican governors that have really been on the far right, have been the most aggressive in advancing this agenda. This is an agenda that privatizes public schools. It's been privatizing prisons and prison services, privatizing our roads, even to foreign firms that really don't care what our roads are like. They just want to make a profit off of us.
Right. And for people who don't know, and probably most of our viewers and listeners do, but ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which was started back in the late 70s by Paul Weyrich and a few other guys, who's the governor of Ohio right now?
Kasich.
John Kasich. He was the co-founder of this thing, along with Paul Weyrich. ALEC pairs one-to-one legislators and lobbyists, and they get together 50-50, legislators and lobbyists, a couple of times a year, and they come up with, quote, model legislation that the legislators then take back and introduce into their House or Senate at the state level around the country. And it is so Republican that a couple of years ago we had at that time he's a state legislator, now he's a member of the United States Congress, on our program from an ALEC convention who was getting dragged out. They discovered he was a Democrat, and he was being, this is Mark Pocan, he was being dragged out live and on the air from an ALEC convention. It was amazing. So
it was a surprise for us. When I received the whistleblower documents that included all these bills that were voted on secretly by corporate lobbyists, as you say, voting as equals with elected state representatives, we had no idea how partisan and right-wing ALEC was. When we took a look at 104 of ALEC's legislative leaders, 103 of them were Republicans.
Right.
So it's pretty partisan, although it claims to be a bipartisan, nonpartisan organization. It really has been pushing far-right ideas, including a lot of climate denial of climate change happening, efforts to make it more difficult to sue if your parent or loved one is killed by an FDA-approved drug, just a whole agenda that actually really isn't pushed by a lot of Americans, but really advances the corporate agendas of their benefactors, people like the Koch brothers and other major corporations, big pharmaceutical firms, foreign pharmaceutical firms as well.
Right. And what's fascinating to me is that while the idea that if you're in charge of a state, you should, and you're the government, right? You're not General Motors. You're the government, the governor or a state legislator. You really should be protecting the commons, the publicly owned spaces, the publicly owned property, and working in the interests of the citizens. But
for ALEC members and by and large Republicans, taking the commons, taking the publicly owned assets and resources and turning them over for private gain, even if it hurts the state or hurts the citizens, is viewed not as a scandal, but as a virtue.
Well, it was really surprising to us. We were at the conference that Mark Pocan was at down in New Orleans in 2011 after we launched ALEC Exposed, and that was the conference where Mark was, you know, required to leave one of the parties.
Yeah, yeah, it was the cigar party.
Exclusive ALEC parties, the cigar party.
Yeah.
But at that conference, we heard from people who were in some of these rooms that, in fact, one of the people who was advancing the ALEC agenda was saying, you know, the government shouldn't own anything. We, the people, shouldn't own anything. We should, you know, sell off our assets. The government shouldn't own buildings. We should all sell off these beautiful buildings to corporations, and we should be their tenants. We should lease those buildings back from them for our own use for the government. Their agenda on privatization is really the sort of far right of the Koch brothers' extremist libertarian view that really denies government a role in protecting the commons, denies that government has done well in many ways to really advance common interests, including through public schools and public education and through other public benefits that are provided much better without the profit motive, that are secured without having someone take a huge cut off the top. What we've seen in these outsourcing examples that we detail in our report on Outsourcing America Exposed is that what you see is these governors outsourcing even economic development, you know, Chamber of Commerce sorts of activities. They take the Department of Commerce within the state and basically push it out into the private sector. And then what you have is sweetheart deals for some of the politicians, basically between the politicians and the corporations, where you have corporations that have been backing a particular politician getting sweetheart deals and tax breaks from these economic development corporations. Then you see instances where there are corporations that have been benefiting from the privatization of schools, spending big money on lobbying and big money on campaign donations. And so I think that this privatization blitz that we've seen is really an example of the corruption of our democracy in many ways.
Yeah. And what's astonishing to me, Lisa, we're talking with Lisa Graves, the executive director of the Center for Media and Democracy, PRWatch.org. Outsource. Give me that website again.
It's Outsourcing America Exposed.org. I know it's a mouthful.
Okay.
Outsourcing America Exposed.
America Exposed. In the minute or so we have left, the thing that is so astonishing to me is that before Reagan, everybody in America, I'm old enough to remember this, understood that George Washington had three horses shot out from underneath him to create a government, that the purpose of the government was to protect the commons. And since Reagan, this right, I mean, they've literally spent billions promoting this right-wing Ayn Rand meme that government is evil and that all these things should most effectively be handled by corporations and billionaires.
Well, that's exactly right. And the Koch brothers were right in the thick of it. Reagan's privatization commission was staffed with one of the leading Koch guys back when Kochs had Citizens for a Sound Economy, the precursor for America's Prosperity. They have been in the middle of this. They have been fueling this craze to privatize for decades, and now they're reaping some of those rewards, but we're the ones stuck paying the bill.
Yeah, yeah, increasingly. And not just the bill financially, the bill in terms of, you know, our prisons don't work, our schools don't work, our roads are falling apart, our infrastructure is disintegrating. There's a big, and you know, look at the healthcare in Texas right now. The bill is huge. Lisa Graves, you are doing great work, all of you over there.
Thanks
so much. The executive director of the Center for Media and Democracy. And the website again.
If you go to prwatch.org, you'll be able to get there.
Find it all from prwatch.org.
Thank
you. Thanks a lot, Lisa. Great talking with you. We'll be right back. It's 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So it's really quite amazing, this study that Lisa Graves was talking about. They nailed Rick Scott, and they nailed Rick Snyder, and Scott Walker. Well, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And David in Hilliard, Ohio, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Hey, David, what's up?
Hello, Tom. First of all, thank you for everything you do.
My honor.
If it weren't for you, I'd go completely insane. But the reason I called is, you know, I realize that you do what you can, but we're not really fighting fire with fire. the Democrats are weak. The Republicans are sociopathic. They play with people's lives. They cut medical care. They don't care about anything but themselves. They go home and they sleep like someone who's just murdered someone and doesn't have a problem with that, because now they can sleep like a baby.
Right.
The reason I'm calling is because we need to call them out. And someone has to run strong enough ads to meet them on their own home turf and to tell, to get their message out that these people are a certain kind of crazy and they're going to take over our democracy. In fact, they're most of the way there now as I see it. So that's...
Here's where it gets strange, David. Take Texas, for example. Wendy Davis, you know, the way that Republicans attack is they always attack from their weakest position, which seems completely counterintuitive. You would say, why would they, you know, take that position? But they historically, Republicans will take their weakest position and attack their opponents, you know, based on that. And so Wendy Davis down in Texas tried that, you know, attacking Greg Abbott, who is paralyzed in a wheelchair, right? He's a paraplegic, and because a tree fell on him, and he got a $10 million settlement for it. And then as attorney general of the state, he fought against victims of similar situations and over and over and over again. And so she puts an ad on the air that factually lays this out. And, of course, the Republicans attacked her for it. But the Democrats are attacking her for it as well. And, you know, oh, that's, you know, isn't that a little over the top? And I'm like, you know, Democrats are just wusses, it seems. You know, it's I get it being civil, you know, and how important and useful it is to be civil.
Well, and I know that you have to do that, because I've seen people, they didn't exactly back you down, but without getting into a dogfight, you have to kind of back off, because especially your panels on your later night show. I mean, two of these people are always fairly crazy, in my opinion. And I'm a rational person. But, you know, we need someone to pound on them. And, you know, these people are evil geniuses, these Republicans. They're sociopathic, but they, you know, they're crazy like a fox, and they know how to twist things around. I mean, look at what's going on with the election now.
Yeah.
This is going down the drain, because they have dumbed down this country to the point where I can't find anyone to talk to who knows what they're talking about. And it's like Rumpelstiltskin. One of these days I'm going to jump up and down until I explode.
Yeah.
It's just getting worse.
I understand. David, thank you for the call. It's getting worse in some regards. The flip side of that, though, David, is more and more Americans are waking up to this. They're not necessarily waking up with full knowledge, and some of them are waking up saying, ah, to hell with it all, which is tragic. We've got to stop, you know, try to do everything we can to prevent that. But I think that people are waking up, and I think the economic crash that's coming is going to wake a lot more people up. David, thanks for the call. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, the Dow is back up. It's up 3%. Wow. Not too shabby. See, the markets bounce around. They go up and down. They come back and forth. It's just what happens. Although, I'm still saying, the structural stuff is totally screwed up. I'm staying away from the market. It's just me. Just me. Don't necessarily follow my advice. Anthony in South Bend, Indiana. Hey, Anthony, what's on your mind?
Yes, I respect you a great deal, and I just want to ask your opinion about the Reapportionment Act of 1929, which limited the number of representatives in the House of Representatives to 435.
Right.
I think our first Congress we had 68 representatives, and we added representatives every 10 years for the census cycle.
Right.
Until 1929.
Right. It was based on a formula that was written into the Constitution that I forget the number, but you know, every 300,000. Every 300,000 people would have one.
More than tripled since 1929. We've even added two states, but we haven't added one representative.
Right.
And I was just wondering how you felt about that.
You know, I think
I think there'd be tremendous benefits if we added representatives.
I agree, and I think you make a good point. It's not going to happen, though. I think a more important first step, and probably a much easier first step than adding new members of Congress, which would require reconfiguring all these buildings in Washington, D.C. and everything else, would be to change, to do like California has done, and change the way the congressional districts are drawn. And Congress, I think, could do this by legislation. Certainly an amendment to the Constitution would be very easy, would make it happen. But I think that it can be done legislatively. In fact, it can easily be done state by state, as California did. And that is, you create nonpartisan commissions to create congressional districts, and you try to make them as close to a polygon as possible, as close as possible to a geometric shape on which all sides are roughly equal. And, you know, without consideration of race or class or gender wouldn't be so much of an issue, but race or class or ethnicity or, you know, language or whatever, without regard to those things, so that you have a truly representative House of Representatives. We don't have that now because of, you know, 150, 200 years of gerrymandering. And I think that it's one for 30,000 in the Constitution. Yeah.
Yeah. If we increase the number of representatives, gerrymandering would be a thing of the past.
Well, maybe they might just get much more finely tuned on it, much tighter on it. And they create even tighter, you know, black only districts, white only districts, Republican only districts, Democrat only districts. So
yeah, well, instead of being elected in from six counties, a representative may be elected from six zip codes.
Right. No, I get it. And I agree with your position, Anthony. I absolutely agree with it. I just think that it's extremely unlikely to happen. And it's a good idea, in my experience, to pick battles you might win. And California has already demonstrated the viability of this. And, of course, Republicans are looking at that going, holy, you know, we don't want this to happen because the Democrats took over California once the state was appropriately apportioned. And they now control the state legislature and the state Senate in such a way that they've even got a large enough majority that they were able to raise taxes and things. So, Anthony, thank you for your call. It's a very thoughtful and a good one. Corey in Seattle. Hey, Corey.
Hey, Tom.
So you wanted to ask if progressives need the Democratic Party?
Yeah. Here, just one second. Let me get you on a better speaker. Sorry. So I've been having this debate with my boss for a while. We listened to your show. Anyways, I voted for Obama my first time I voted, and I didn't want to vote for Democrats anymore after I started getting more into politics because they're just all corporate. They're just the same as Republicans if you look at it from the right angle.
It's not true, Corey. It's not true.
Not true or true?
No, it's not true. There's 90-some-odd members of the House Congressional Progressive Caucus who are good, solid, not corporate Democrats at all. And there's a couple of good senators out there who are not corporate Democrats at all. Probably the most prominent in the Democratic Party is Sherrod Brown and Al Franken. These are good guys, and these are not corporate Democrats.
Well, okay, I do concede that there are good Democrats, but it seems to me that the Democratic National Party, you know, like as an entity, just isn't really getting what the progressives want done.
Well, there's a reason for that.
Well, I know the obstructionism and all the things like that.
No. The reason for that is that people like you, who are good progressives, are not showing up and taking over the Democratic Party. In the places where progressives have taken over the Democratic Party, you end up with good progressives going to Congress, people like Keith Ellison and Raul Grijalva. But in those congressional districts where progressives are not showing, you know, the Democratic Party is a multi-billion-dollar machine. And it has all these resources all across the country. And if you and I were to sit down, Corey, and say, hey, let's take over NBC or let's take over CBS, we'd have to raise billions of dollars to do it. It would be a major fight. I mean, taking over a for-profit corporation or media corporation. But you could take over a political party without a lot of money and with, you know, all it takes is some sweat equity. Case in point, the Koch brothers and the Tea Party taking over the Republican Party. They did this in a very intentional manner. You go and look at, I think it's called the Concord Coalition. It's Concord something or other. They've got these videos that they pumped out in 2009, 2010, telling people how to show up at their local Republican Party and run for precinct committee person. And they pointed out that the precinct committee people are the ones who decide who's going to be on the ballot in the primaries. They're the people who decide what the platform for the party is going to be. And if you get the Tea Party taking over a majority of the precinct committee positions, they basically control the local party.
You put up, you can put up four, five, six people in the primary. As long as they're all Tea Partiers, it doesn't matter which one wins. They're all Tea Partiers, and you're going to end up with a Tea Party member of Congress. And they did that, and they've got like 100 members of Congress now. We could be doing that in the Democratic Party. You could be doing that in the Democratic Party, Corey.
Well, I live in Seattle, and I think the Democratic Party's pretty well got this place wrapped up. But I'm just wondering if it would be easier for, if we had, you know, a group that wanted to take over the Democratic Party, would it be easier to just start an independent party or an Occupy party? Or?
No, it, you know, just practically speaking, it would cost a screaming fortune. This is, you know, when David Cobb ran on the Green Party ticket in 2004, his position was, if you're in a swing state, don't vote for me, vote for the Democrats, which is kind of moving in that direction. But the Green Party since then, I think, has gotten a little more alienated from the
You're
Democrats.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
These are just the unfortunate realities of how our country is constructed. We do not have universal instant runoff voting, and we don't have proportional representation. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 28 minutes before the hour. Talk media for the sane among us. And time for a crazy alert for the day.
I have so got brains.
Well, why don't you use them? Go! I haven't got a brain.
Dumbest thing ever.
Because I haven't got a brain.
That's the dumbest thing I ever heard.
Oh, if I only had a brain.
Yeah, 30 for this. This is from Newser. Read less, know more. Newser.com. A story by Kate Siemens, S-E-A-M-O-N-S, on the Newser staff. Ah, vanity, she writes. A 34-year-old Ohio woman was hit with robbery, aggravated robbery, and kidnapping charges, all in thanks to an unflattering Facebook photo. A warrant was issued for her arrest. This was Monica Hargrove. And they put up this picture that they'd gotten off Facebook, apparently, and she objected. She didn't like the picture. So she considered it an unattractive shot, photo. So she called the police, insisting that that photo, her mugshot, be taken down. So the police said, well, you know, if you don't like the picture, come on into the police station. We'll take a different picture and we'll put that out as your mugshot on the wanted poster. And she said, okay, and came into the police department to have her picture taken. Yeah. So I guess her mugshot is taken down now. She's in jail. Darwin Awards, right? Kelly in Berkeley, California. Hey, Kelly. Bernie's coming to town?
Bernie's coming to town. He's going to be speaking for the Richmond Progressive Alliance. Those are the people who are running against the Chevron money.
Uh-huh.
In Richmond, California, and he will be at the Civic Center tonight at 7 p.m.
Oh, that's
and
cool.
there's a fundraiser that starts before that. So just to let people know. And then I also took some of your advice, and I've been involved in the Tony Sermon campaign since July, and campaigning and canvassing is wonderful.
Oh, great. Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
You know, it is so empowering to do something rather than just complaining about things. It really, really and truly is. So anybody in the Richmond, California area, get thee down to the, where, what did you say the building was?
Okay, it's the Richmond Memorial Auditorium at 403 Civic Center Plaza. That's in the center of Richmond.
Okay, so get down there tonight, and when you see Bernie, yell, brunch with Bernie!
Yeah.
Give him a shout out from us. Okay.
Yeah, so it's really exciting to be there. And like I said, I just love being involved in the campaign. It is so energizing.
That is great. Good on you, Kelly. You are what we all should be striving to be. Thank you so much for the call and for what you're doing. Jim in Santa Rosa, California. Hey, Jim.
Hi. We should immediately require that all healthcare workers have paid sick leave.
And not just healthcare workers, I think everybody, but in particular, people who have contact with the public, like restaurant workers, retail employees, and people in hospitals.
Right. And I've noticed that in Liberia, they've started home care for people with Ebola.
Yeah.
So if you get Ebola, they'll drop everything by at your house.
Right. This is because they just don't have the facilities anymore. It puts family members at an entire and at a horrible risk. But they just, you know, their hospital, Medicine Sans Frontières, the Doctors Without Borders, they have 19 doctors who have been infected, 17 doctors who have been infected with Ebola now. 9 of them have died. Right. And Liberia had, you know, it's kind of a libertarian country. They don't have much government infrastructure. It's the kind of country that, you know, the Koch brothers and other right-wing libertarians would like America to become. And so, you know, a lot of the doctors and a lot of the nurses in that country are dead. And it's just a screaming disaster. And this is one of the reasons, you know, right now in most parts of the United States, people, you know, restaurant workers, retail workers, they may have somebody who, you know, they may be the spouse or the child or the parent of somebody who's working in a hospital and is exposed to Ebola, and they're feeling sick, but they're going to come to work because they don't want to lose their job. And that's nuts. And it's not just Ebola. I mean, it could be the flu or anything else. Jim, thank you. Very well said. Sandy in Downers Grove, Illinois. Hey, Sandy, what's up?
Yeah, Tom, I was just wondering, for a while here now, I'm thinking about that hospital in Texas. And wouldn't it be just so great if the CEO or the administration came out and said, look, this is where we fell down, and this is information that we want to give out to all healthcare workers and to all other hospitals, because, you know, I just don't understand with our type of medical facilities how this could happen. You know, we have gloves, we have universal precautions. And so I go back to thinking, was it lack of staffing, lack of supplies, and, you know, staffing I'm sure is a big element. But I just think morally it would be good to, let's face it, there were mistakes made. Let's get out there now and really solve the problem.
Yeah, I was just looking through my papers here for some details to back up what you're suggesting. Texas Presbyterian is a not-for-profit hospital. However, there's a big but in that. It is funded in part by a vulture capital firm, a Mitt Romney kind of company, and it's like a nonprofit front group basically for members of the board of directors and members of this private equity firm who have loaned it money. And they because it's a not for profit, instead of declaring a profit, which you might have to pay taxes on, they declare an operating margin. And then use that money to distribute bonuses and things and money back to the investors. And this is from Becker's Hospital CFO, BeckersHospitalReview.com. And it's about the company Texas Health Resources, which owns this hospital. And it says, for Arlington-based Texas Health Resources, 2013 was a very profitable year as the massive health system posted $319.3 million in operating income, a 10.6% jump from 2012. Revenue at THR increased to $3.85 billion, resulting in an 8.3% operating margin. That's their profit, 8.3% functionally. THR's operating margin was 7.8% in 2012. The majority of the system's net patient service revenue came from managed care contracts and other commercial, Medicare and Medicaid was 34%, blah, 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 blah. And I have been trying to find out, you know, who are the executives in charge of this and how much of a bonus do they get? And it seems like all this stuff is totally opaque. It's really, really hard to get any information on it. But,
And you can be sure that there's not then. If that's the case, you can be sure that information, they will really close ranks and not get out information that's needed on this disastrous, what had happened. Because there were so many mistakes in that chain.
Yep.
Making a profit, first of all, at a hospital, I don't understand how you could do something like that. I really don't. Shouldn't the money go back into staffing? Shouldn't the money go back into education?
Hospitals should be not-for-profits, and they should not have handshake arrangements or pass-through arrangements with venture capital firms, private equity firms, or any other for-profit entity. They absolutely should. But because, you know, we've had this change in the tax laws that have allowed not-for-profits to become basically fronts for people seeking profits over the last 30 years as part of the whole Reaganomics agenda, you now see, I mean, it used to be that The head of the Red Cross did not earn $700,000 a year. Remember when Elizabeth Dole became the head of the Red Cross? I think it was during the Reagan years, and she made $700,000. Everybody was like shocked. People were shocked back then. They're not anymore. Now you've got university presidents, nonprofit universities, who are making millions. We've got, I mean, it's just the whole nonprofit thing has become a sad joke. It's really tragic. It's become just another tax dodge. And you're absolutely right, Sandy. We have no corporation has any business running a hospital for the profit motive. It should be part of our public health commons. Sandy, thank you for the call. Monica in Raleigh, North Carolina. Hey, Monica, you wanted to talk about Alec?
Yeah. You were talking to that woman earlier about Alec. And I remember a while back how you were saying that corporations, since Alec exposed, corporations were leaving Alec in droves, and Walmart was one of the last corporations you mentioned leaving. And it just got me to wonder, where are they going? What group are they going to?
You know, I don't know. My guess is that some of these, I mean, Google famously in the last few weeks said, we're leaving Walmart. The CEO of Google said, because we're leaving Alec because they literally are lying to you. That was his phrase about climate change. And so, you know, I think that there are some companies that are just saying, enough of this already. This Alec thing is not working for us. But that doesn't mean that they're not trying to buy legislators. They just hire their own lobbying firm in Washington, D.C. and go merrily about their way. I mean, they're still doing the same things because the rules of the game haven't changed. The rules of the game have been established by the U.S. Supreme Court that it is perfectly all right to buy and sell politicians. It's perfectly all right to...
They don't need an ALEC organization anymore.
That's correct. The very, very large corporations don't. And ALEC is, you know, losing influence at the federal or at the state-by-state level, although there are new organizations that are working at the local level that are funded by the same people who put ALEC together. And you've got, you know, these very, very large national entities that are working to elect people, the Americans for Prosperity and Crossroads GPS, Karl Rove's group. The first was the Koch brothers, the second was Karl Rove's group, all this stuff. So, it's at a certain level, it's just rearranging the chairs. Monica, thank you for the call. I do not see this as some great victory over Alec. I mean, you can take down the players, but the broken system remains. It's time to call out the U.S. Supreme Court, amend the Constitution, undo their damage.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And if you want to amend the Constitution to undo Alec's damage, go to MoveToAmend.org and sign up. And welcome back, 15 minutes before the hour. And Amario in Folsom, California. Mario? Hello? Mario's not answering. Jim in Concord, North Carolina, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Hey, Jim, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you, Tom. Thanks. So I guess that caller, a couple of calls ago, he was so frustrated with the Democrats. Mm-hmm. And so my wife and I are talking, and we said, we need Tom's opinion. So there's going to be a crash. We know it's going to be a crash. We've read your book. We can see it coming. But we see the Democrats being blamed for it.
Yep.
And just like the Wendy Davis thing, they'll just sit back and do nothing.
Yep.
And that's what's so frustrating about these Democrats. So what do you think? Is this the end of the Democratic Party?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so at all. I think that the crashes are transitions, and transitions provide opportunities for change. If you look at the history, I mean, you've read my book. You look at the history of the United States. The crash of 1929 led to the New Deal. The crash of 1856, 1857 led to the Civil War and the end of slavery. The crash of 1700 led to the Declaration of Independence in 1776 and the creation of the United States. Roughly every 80 years, we reboot this country, and we do it coming out of an economic debacle, which has been the result of too much greed by people who today would call themselves Republicans and conservatives. Back then, they've called themselves, you know, in the 1860s, they called themselves Democrats. In the 1700s, they called themselves Whigs or Tories. I mean, it's, you know, they have different, but the names may change, but the players are essentially of the same mindset. So the thing that concerns me and I think that you put your finger on a very, very important point here, is that if the crash happens in the next 6 months or even 12 months, and the Republicans can succeed in preventing the president from passing any kind of stimulus that might get us out of it, and thus, you know, force a longer disaster, then they will have an opportunity in 2016 that Barack Obama did not have in 2008. If the crash of 2007-2008, the Bush crash, had happened a year earlier, if the stock market had started to fall in late 2006, early 2007, instead of in 2008, and Americans had perceived the economy going in the crapper back, you know, a year and a half earlier, then George Bush and the Republicans would have been seen as basically Herbert Hoover. And America would have been horrified, and Obama would have had a much larger Democratic majority in both the House and Senate. He would have had a clearer mandate. And I think probably, there's no doubt in my mind that he would have governed in a far more progressive way. He would have had the ability to govern in a far more progressive way, and America would be a very different country right now. But that's not what happened. When he came into office, most Americans didn't even realize how bad the situation was, and he got us out of it. I mean, you know, it was pretty amazing. If you look at the chart, at the graph of unemployment statistics, you know, the month after the stimulus, boom, suddenly we're no longer, you know, losing 700,000 jobs a month. So I believe that this is the Republican strategy. I believe for the last 6 years, their strategy has been to deny Obama any meaningful victories and to trash the small ones he's had, like Obamacare. Jim, thanks for the call. And I think that going forward for the next 2 years, their goal is going to be to crash the economy. 10 minutes before the hour, the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program. Becky in Iowa City, Iowa. Hey, you've got a coming to Iowa story?
Thank you for everything you do.
You're welcome. Thank you for calling.
I just wanted to say that Elizabeth Warren is coming to Iowa City, Iowa on this coming Sunday for a Get Out the Vote event for Bruce Braley.
That's great.
She will be at the Iowa Memorial Union, which is right downtown. It's our student center, on the second floor ballroom. Right. And she's to begin speaking at 1, so all of us who are going to get out the vote are going to be there early. But
that's marvelous. Becky, thanks.
Starts at 1.
Thanks for the heads up. And isn't it fascinating that while our perceived as middle of the road president, and I don't want to get into a debate about what he really is, but you know, he's perceived as kind of the middle of the road, he's having a hard time finding places where candidates want him to show up. But a clear populist progressive, Elizabeth Warren, everybody wants her. It really says something about the future of progressivism, I think, in the United States. And
The president could come to Iowa City and people would love him.
I think so. I think so, too. But that's not conventional wisdom right now in the Democratic Party, which is tragic. Becky, thank you for the heads up, and thank you for letting us all know. Bobby in Petersburg, Tennessee. Hey, Bobby.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about global warming.
Okay.
I was talking to a guy that answered the phone for Billy Spivey, which is a state representative here in Tennessee, running for state representative. And he was trying to tell me that the Arctic is expanding instead of contracting.
The Arctic or Antarctica?
Antarctica,
down in the south.
Either one, both of them.
Yeah, well, you know, the way it works, it is a great example, Bobby, of figures don't lie, but liars can figure. Every summer in the Arctic is an ocean, right, at the North Pole. That's an ocean, and it's covered with ice, or it used to be covered with ice. And every summer that ice melts, and the area of no ice, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and it just hit an all-time record this last summer. And then during the winter, as it gets cold, the ice comes back out and the area of water gets smaller. So, yeah, the ice sheets expand in the winter in the Arctic. In Antarctica, you've got a very interesting phenomena. There are parts of Antarctica. Now, Antarctica is a continent,
like North America, or probably a better analogy would be Australia. It's about the size of Australia, you know, at the South Pole. And on top of that land is a mile of ice, or just a, you know, massive amount of ice. And if that ice melts and slides off into the ocean, that's going to raise sea levels, along with the ice that's on top of Greenland, because it's not ocean ice. Ice melting in the Arctic, in the North Pole, will not affect sea level consequentially, other than just, you know, warming of oceans causes them to expand slightly. But it really doesn't affect sea level. But the ice coming off Antarctica does. And what's happening in Antarctica is that because it is warming down there, you're in Tennessee. I grew up in Michigan, which is probably a lot colder than Petersburg, Tennessee. But I don't know if you've ever noticed that when it's really, really cold, that you don't get really heavy, very large snowfalls. You get the heavy, wet snowfalls when it's right around 32, 31, 30 degrees. You know what I'm talking about, Bobby?
Yeah.
So the
yeah.
warmer it is, the heavier and more intense the snow is. The colder it is, the less moisture the atmosphere can hold, so the less snow comes down. And it's just, there's physics to this thing. And so what's happening is, as it's warming in Antarctica, more snow is falling on a large part of Antarctica, and there are parts of the Antarctic ice sheets that are growing. That's true. On the other hand, there's also parts of the Antarctic ice sheets where it's like glaciers that are going out into the sea that are falling off into the ocean at record rates and that are sliding off the continent. The fact that there is more snow falling in on Antarctica right now is actually a bad sign. It's a dangerous sign of global warming. So, you know, your friend, if he's repeating half truths that he's hearing or bumper stickers from right wing media, it's unfortunate. You could probably set him straight. It's not hard to dig this stuff out with a search engine. Say what? Yeah.
He represents the Republican Party and
yeah, you know. Well, then he's probably just lying, you know, because they take money from the fossil fuel industry.
That's what I was trying to get across there.
Yeah. Yeah.
They don't have any scientific facts. They just get on radio talk show host here in Tennessee. They get on radio and say stuff like that.
Yeah. But
they have no scientific facts.
No, they'll just pull it out of their backside.
Lies after lies.
Yep. I'm with you. Bobby, thanks for the call, and thanks for the wake up here. Joan in Spencer, New York, listening to WNYY. Hey, Joan, you wanted to talk about determining who your kids play with?
Yeah.
We have just a minute to the end of the show.
I was a little bit upset because we had two kids, boy and girl, and they're both really, really well behaved, and they picked the right friends. But my daughter picked this one little girl, a sad little kid in elementary school, and she followed her all through junior high school into high school, and if it weren't for our daughter, this kid wouldn't have finished high school.
Mm.
So, you can have the positive effect on it. And the guidance counselor said, she should not be associating with this girl. She should not be. Well, it improved the kid. She finished high school, at least. Our daughter did finish college, but she finished high school.
That's wonderful.
There are positive sides to these, too. There's more side to the coin.
Yeah, I guess in presenting that story, there was a certain amount of almost a libertarian, you know, I, me, mine to it. But I would submit to you that if your daughter did that and with that friend, that friend and your daughter probably hold similar values. And, you know, I was talking about values, not abilities. But Joan, thank you very much for the call. And thanks for your concern. And thank you all. Thanks to you for being with us today. Another great day. Tomorrow we'll have more. And in the meantime, there's so much you can do. Get over to movetoamend.org. Go to Progressive Democrats of America, pdamerica.org. Go to nationalnursesunited.org. They really need some help. Go to prwatch.org. Some of the things that we've talked about today, there's some great organizations out there. You can make a difference. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.